shut off for some reason. Give that a second. Good morning. It's my pleasure to stand before you again today. Despite the absences that were mentioned, we do still have a pretty good crowd, and we are thankful for everyone's presence here today. We'll give that a second to warm up, but I feel fairly confident that most of us here, if not all of us, are at least familiar with a concept of the fear of commitment. Usually when you hear that, you may know someone that personally has that issue, but it's usually kind of a source of comedy or whatever in a television show or maybe a movie where the main character can't bring themselves to commit to something, whether that would be a marriage or something along those lines. We know what that concept is. And so the fear of commitment is defined or described as the avoidance of maybe a long-term partnership or marriage. It's the avoidance of something that the person would normally recognize as possibly being a good thing in their life, but they are afraid to make that final commitment. And so some common reasons maybe why someone might have a fear of commitment, especially like towards a marriage or a relationship, it could be that the person with their whom they're having that relationship might not be their best match. They may be waiting for something better to come along, or there may be someone out there that they think would be a better match, or maybe it's just they don't want to lose their independence. They want to be able to do what they want to do when they want to do it and not have someone else, you know, cramping their style. Whatever the case may be, the situation usually they don't want to make a change, and so that commitment would require that change to take place. So with that in mind this morning, I wanted to look into whether or not maybe a fear of commitment is a reason why some people neglect or just decide not to become a Christian. There may be factors in that, and that they don't want to commit to that. So this morning, I think we owe it to ourselves to look into those things that really a Christian is committing to, what they are expecting to have that change in their life. And so there are lots of different examples and different verses I could focus on, but I think there's one that will do us well to look at. If we look at Titus chapter 3, verse 14. That verse reads, "And let our people learn to devote themselves to good works, so as to help cases of urgent need and not be unfruitful." You might find it curious that for a verse that I'm going to use as a basis for a conversation about fear of commitment, you won't find commitment anywhere in that verse. But you do see the word devote, which of course is a root word of devotion. The King James and several other versions, I think they use the word maintain. And so they all can kind of work together, because these three words, commitment, devotion, and maintenance, provide the understanding of an ongoing relationship and the effort that's needed in order to adhere to that relationship. So if we look at the word devotion, which is what's used here in Titus chapter 3, it means love, loyalty, or enthusiasm for a person, activity, or cause. And a secondary definition for devotion is religious worship or observance. And the dictionary which I used provided a usage, like, you know, use it in a sentence. And they said the order's aim was to live a life of devotion. And so the picture we can get from the usage of the word devotion, and especially in that sentence, is that this is an ongoing commitment. It's an ongoing need to maintain a level of commitment there. And so in a Christian's case, it's working towards the worship and the praise and the life of service that is expected from a follower, a believer. And so we have to then look and see what it is this verse is telling us about the devotion that Paul is writing to about to Titus in his work. And so in this verse in chapter 3, Paul's telling Titus that their people should be learning to devote themselves before focusing on the object of their devotion. I want to make a short detour into who Paul is talking about here, the people that he's writing to Titus, that this is what he should be telling them. And so we just need to visit the first chapter of Titus to find out who it is that Paul is speaking. Titus 1 verse 5 says, "This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you." Titus had been sent to teach the Cretans. And yes, the Cretans were a crude people, and that's why sometimes you might call someone a Cretan. That is exactly the nature of the people found on the island of Crete. But this verse is found just two chapters earlier, and we have to believe that in chapter 3, Paul is still talking about the Cretans to whom Titus had been sent to speak. And so Paul, just actually a few verses before our passage, in chapter 3, verse 8, says, "The saying is trustworthy, and I want you to insist on these things, so that those who have believed in God may be careful to devote themselves to good works. These things are excellent and profitable for people." So not just any Cretan is being included in this group of people to whom Paul is referring. It is those on Crete who had believed in God and had become a follower. And if you'll notice in verse 8 that they are to devote themselves. This is the same group about which Paul is speaking in verse 14. So they are the group that is needing to devote themselves. And so we know who these people are, and we need to know and that they need to devote themselves to something. And so Paul then adds an additional term. He says they need to learn. There are things in this world where becoming devoted to them is fairly easy. No one had to tell me that I needed to, or teach me to become devoted to Cheez-Its, but I had one, and that devotion kicked in. That wasn't a hard choice. That was devoted. That devotion came pretty easily. But most things to which you need to become devoted takes effort. And it takes dedication, it takes purpose, and it takes that commitment. But the payoff will come in the end. I found a quote by a man, I have no idea who he is, but I just searched for commitment quotes and so forth, and this man named Peter F. Drucker said this: "Unless commitment is made, there are only promises and hopes, but no plans." And I think that fits the idea. If you don't sit and make, well, we talked about succession planning in our class this morning, without a plan, chaos ensues. And so if we are committed to something, whatever that is, we have to sit and plan what we're going to do. You don't stumble into successfully committing yourself to something. You need to take stock of the situation. You need to see what is required in order to be able to fulfill your commitment. And a decision needs to be made about what you're willing to do in order to meet that commitment. You can set any kind of goal you want, whether it's physical, emotional, financial, spiritual, whatever the goal may be. But unless you make a plan, execute that plan, and then commit to it, it's likely not going to come to fruition. It's not going to happen. And so we need to understand that learning to worship God has always been a part of following him. I've got three passages here that I'm going to read. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 9 and 10, "Only take care and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Make them known to your children and your children's children. How on the day that you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, the Lord said to me, 'Gather the people to me, that I may let them hear my words, so that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children so.'" Deuteronomy 5 verse 1 says, "And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, 'Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the rules that I speak in your hearing today, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them.'" And then in Psalm 119, verses 4 through 8, "You have commanded your precepts to be kept diligently. Oh, that my ways may be steadfast in keeping your statutes. Then I shall not be put to shame. Having my eyes fixed on all your commandments, I will praise you with an upright heart. When I learn your righteous rules, I will keep your statutes. Do not utterly forsake me." We all can learn what it takes to follow the Lord. These passages were just reiterating over and over that they had to devote themselves. They had to be diligent. And so they needed to learn to do good, and we do as well. And you do that by learning about God's laws. So what Paul is telling Titus in this verse is that their commitment is going to require planning. It's going to require effort. Just saying you're going to do things generally doesn't make them happen. So with that in mind, we need to look at three things to which Christians need to devote themselves in order to become faithful followers. The first thing, we have to be committed to doing good works. Not a reference to a type of job or a profession and how well we do that. That's not what's being spoken of. Instead, it's a reference to the type of life that you're expected to live and that we should be living. It's the same word we find in verse 8, which we had read earlier. So the best way of explaining this is really could be summed up in this way. We could be employed in good works, to defend good works and to recommend the performance of them, and then to promote and forward good works, to be always first in them. Those are concepts that we find about good works. James chapter 2, verses 17 and 18 says, "So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, 'You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works.'" John Wesley, who founded the Wesleyan Methodist Church, was quoted as saying this, "Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can." Well, we certainly have doctrinal issues and conflicts with what John Wesley espoused, but he got this part right. There's never a time where we shouldn't be willing and able to do a work for someone, to do something for someone. We should always be open to having that opportunity. And we could do much worse than to live by this standard. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, Peter writes, "Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God in the day of visitation." This passage tells us all we need to know about the role and the place of good works in our life. By doing good deeds, it will prevent people from trying to cast us as being hypocrites or sinners like they are. Instead, they will find no reason to criticize us, and our good deeds instead will provide glory to the Father above. And so, with this in mind, that these good works need to be a constant source of, or a constant output from us, the next thing we need to look at and what we should devote ourselves is, we need to help cases of urgent need, Paul writes here in Titus 3:14. To help cases of urgent need, other translators say, King James says, "for necessary uses." The NIV says, "to provide for urgent needs." Now, I will say this about this verse and in this phrase, there's little said about it. I can find verses all day long about good works, but verses that deal with urgent need, it's a little bit lacking. And so that proved a little tougher. But one passage that probably is related to this, I found in Matthew chapter 5, verses 34 through 40. Matthew chapter 25, verses 34 through 40. Jesus is speaking. "Then the king will say to those on the right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me.' Then the righteous will answer, saying, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?' And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. In all these cases, I think, for the most part, these would fit the category of an urgent and necessary need. He mentions people that were hungry and thirsty. They were alone. They were naked. They were sick or in prison. Every one of those sounds pretty urgent. There's a need. And he says that we are told that those of us who attend to people that are in these conditions will not just find appreciation here on earth from those that we would be helping, but we'd also find appreciation when we inherit the kingdom that's been prepared for us. That is our reward for doing these things and acting in this way. And so the passage then says that those that saw these people in these conditions and did nothing will inherit the eternal fire prepared for the angel and his devils. And so it doesn't take much time to help someone, but quite often it takes a lot of effort. And so we need to be ready and devoted to doing that. And a related quote I found said that opportunity is often missed because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work. That is true for physical work, and it's especially true for spiritual work. And so we cannot grow weary with the thought of doing things for others and helping others. And the last thing that we find here in Titus chapter 3, verse 14, to which we should devote ourselves, is to not be unfruitful. I try to do my best with my grammar. I try not to end sentences and prepositions and things like that, but I know this is a double negative, not to be unfruitful. And so I don't sure why he chose to state it in this manner, it being a double negative, but if you cancel them out, basically it's saying we should devote ourselves to be fruitful. We should be devoting ourselves being fruitful with other, you know, towards others. And so either way, we can see what point it is that he's making here. And here in chapter 3, verse 14, if we just look up a few verses earlier in verse 9, he says, but avoid foolish controversies, genealogies, dissensions, and quarrels about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. He's telling Titus not to waste time with those things, that they're not going to help advance the cause of Christ, and these genealogies and the quarrels are just going to take your attention and focus away from the things that you should be, you know, upon which you should be focusing. And so getting caught up in this type of activity will not lead us to being a fruitful producer in the kingdom. And so when talking about our responsibility to sow the word today and about how our fruitfulness should be judged, it shouldn't be solely based upon the results. Because you can preach to everybody, you can talk earnestly with everybody, you can do a good work for everybody. Like Chris said, we'll help you, but we're more concerned about your soul. It doesn't matter how good of a deliverer of that message we may be. There are so many factors when it comes to a person's willingness, well, to make a commitment to the Lord, that we can't be judged by that. No matter how hard we try, there's always going to be people that just can't be reached. Maybe it's because of their preconceived notions about the gospel. Or maybe they'll worry they'll lose their friends and family. The relationships that they have will have to be severed because of that. Maybe it's because they don't want to go back to their jobs and have their friends realize that they are doing things differently. So there's all kinds of decisions that people and individuals can make external of whatever message we deliver to them. And so We won't be judged by the output. But in my past life, I was a cold caller, and then I actually managed a team of cold callers, and I always told them, we can't control the output, but what we can control is the effort. We can control how often we're doing something, how well we're doing it, and in the case of sowing the seed in today's world, how boldly we are willing to go out and do that. And so that is something on which we will be measured, our effort. And if we are found lacking, well, then we're no better than the people that we are preaching to that are deciding not to make that commitment. We will inherit the judgment of eternal peril that is awaiting them if we are not willing to use that same effort. And so the last passage I want to use in support of my message this morning is going to be found in John chapter 15, verses 1 through 6. Jesus speaking to his disciples. This is about a three-chapter period where he just is praying for them. And he's offering these words to help them for just a very short time when he's going to be gone and they are going to have a lot of responsibility put on them. And so in this passage where he's speaking with them, he makes this statement. I am the true vine and my Father is the vine dresser. Each branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself, unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers, and the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. I think no passage does a better job of explaining the benefits and the perils regarding our ability to be fruitful. If we produce fruit, it'll be because we are abiding in Jesus. And if we produce no fruit, then we are of no use to him, and he will not allow us to abide in him. But as it says there at the end of that passage, our branch will wither and it'll dry up, and it'll be gathered up, and it'll be thrown into the fire and burned and destroyed. Sounds like a very similar outcome to our last point, that those that don't do the works that they see in front of them, when they have the opportunity to help someone or do something that will impact someone's life, and they choose not to do it, they will be thrown into that eternal fire with the angel and the devil and his angels. And so the question I want to ask you today is, what is it going to be for you? As you look at your life, can you say that you've made that commitment? Those of us who have stepped forward and decided to make that commitment, we have to make sure that we are doing things that are necessary to be able to allow us to maintain that commitment. If you can, and you maintain that, and you are fruitful and so forth, well, then we deserve the glory that's awaiting for us in the eternal life that is promised. If not, then the only thing you have to look forward to is the eternal lake of fire into which you will be thrown. It doesn't have to be that way. You're hearing my voice means you are alive and you still have an opportunity to make changes to your life. And it doesn't take much for you to decide what you need to do, but it does take the fear of commitment of that life that follows. And so we need to devote ourselves, those of us who have made that decision, to continue and work on our life of service so we can be found faithful and gain that reward that's waiting for us. That reward is a home in heaven that's been prepared for us since the beginning of time, and it is awaiting us. And so, as Christians, we know we struggle at times, and that you need to know that you know that you need to be stronger. And if you need the encouragement of the church, because you've had the opportunities and maybe you have stumbled, and if you need that encouragement, you can come forward and you can seek that assistance, and we'll pray for you so that you can have that strength. But if you're someone that hasn't made that decision to enter into that commitment, well, then the effort is not needed because you haven't made that decision. You can come forward this morning and you could indicate your desire to be baptized in the waters behind us, repenting of your sins, confessing that Jesus is Lord, and you can then enter into that lifelong commitment. If you're in need of any services of the church this morning, we ask that you come forward and we will attend to you as we stand and as we sing.